You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline on this beautiful, sunny December day. I'm happy to be back in Iowa after...
Oh, really? Are you?
After being around the world.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, so I spent some time in Texas and then to Asia. My first trip to China and Hong Kong, and it was interesting, but I don't have enough to write a book about it, enough insights.
Okay.
Because I was only there for about 10 days. However, our current guest...
Yes, does.
Has spent a lot more time, right. Not in China, but in another part of, I think it's considered Asia, in India. And Caroline, you want to tell our listeners about today's guest?
Our guest today is, excuse my voice, I have this thing that's going around. Susan Klauber was born and raised in the Northern Ontario mining hub of Sudbury, Canada, and has lived and traveled in Europe, North and South America, and India. Married to an American, she currently spends her retirement time in Fairfield, Iowa. That's nice. Where she writes poetry and pursues her interest in spiritual development to create peace and uplift the collective consciousness. Her book today that we're talking about is Sound of the Sacred Beads, A Poet's Journey into India. And it's her second book of poetry and prose, based on 8 winters of living and traveling in India. It draws upon the author's many years of experience with transcendental meditation to explore the inner realm of India and its impact on her life. She feels poetry and India are natural partners that lead individuals into a common spiritual core where the most profound knowledge and experience of life occur. Welcome, Susan.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's welcome. Nice to see the face, Carolyn, go with the voice. Yeah. I've known Monica for a while.
A long time.
Yes.
20 years maybe?
Probably. Well, we've been here since 83, so
yeah,
it's probably almost that long.
Probably.
Right?
And I've known you through those years as a athlete and a businesswoman and now as a writer.
Right.
Now, how long have you actually been writing?
Well, I guess I've been writing off and on. I was a closet writer, a closet poet for many years. I never really started until after university. So this would be in 68. The big thing was to travel in Europe in those days. And I ended up doing that for actually a couple of years, traveling and working and whatnot. And because I was by myself, it was quite nice to talk to myself through the words. And it started coming right then. The first poem I actually wrote was in Madrid, Spain. You know, so those kinds of things went on, and I kept, every once in a while I would write, and it just built.
Had you then studied poetry or writing?
No, actually I hadn't. In fact, I tell a story. When the first time I ever, you know, really got into a poem was, I think it was, I don't know, something in grade school. And it was a wonderful poem, I thought. And I could just see, you know, I just feel this horse charging over the plains and everything, you know. And, of course, the teacher gave me a 0 because it wasn't a horse at all. It was a train. And, of course, they were using a metaphor. And I had picked up the metaphor and just gone right into it and not seen it for what it was. So it was kind of a shock.
Mom, you wouldn't have done that when you were an English teacher,
no,
would you?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. But, you know, I'm just thinking, what wonderful memories you have of your travels because you have them in poetry.
Mm, right. Well, my poetry tends to be a lot of prose type of things, narrative.
Uh-huh.
So it's, my husband calls it prosatry.
That's good.
But,
I like that.
Well, your prose is very poetic too, because this book is a combination of prose pieces and poetry. And I'd like to actually talk about how you distinguish what's a poem and what's a prose piece.
That is something you could probably ask Diane Frank. All the workshops I took with her, you know, she'd be better person. But yeah, I don't know. But anyway, carrying back on the other theme, when I did come to Fairfield, then the writing came out, and it was much more predominant. And then I started taking workshops with Diane Frank and did that for a good 10 years, every week. once or twice a week we'd have a piece that had to be prepared.
Wow.
So it was
quite a
training.
It kept you going, didn't it?
It really did.
Mm-hmm.
But
now,
it was wonderful.
As you were doing this, were you always intending to write a book, to publish, or was it really just for your own enjoyment, your own contentment?
I think it was, I guess, to fulfill myself, really. Coming here, having the orientation strictly to just do the meditations, that's what we basically came here for, was the group program. And not having different outlets that, you know, other things that I could really relate to other than my sports. So what I did was that I started kind of going through my little repertoire of things that I enjoyed doing. And I remember that my mother had said, "You should write because you write well." And that stuck with me, and for some reason that came to me then. And I said, okay, so maybe I should actually get the courage and go out and not come out of the closet. And actually, so I went to one of Diane Frank's workshops, and she was wonderful to encourage this person who had gotten a zero before. That wasn't an issue. She doesn't teach like that. And it
she
was
wonderful. Grading you.
No.
Yeah.
Accepting every voice that was there. And her teaching method was wonderful. So that really inspired me to keep on going. And I just kept writing. And she didn't care whether it was poetry or prose. You just write. Get the voice out. And so when you go back to your original question, how do you distinguish between prose and poetry at this point, it was just picking up her main point, which is, I guess, the poet's thing, is to speak in the images, have the images speak for themselves, don't try and let the subtext come through. And so that's why when you point out that the prose has that a lot, I just rely on that kind of writing technique in order to really bring the reader in. And I always do enjoy expressing something so that the reader gets into it, that they get some experience out of it. Rather than,
and it may not be the same experience that you
absolutely.
Are that you were describing, but it can be something completely different.
Absolutely.
Just like the horse rather than the train.
Exactly. Yeah. But hopefully, and I think as you go along refining the writing, it's getting closer and closer to your voice or my voice in my particular case. So anything that becomes more and more honest to myself then obviously becomes more universal, because you're touching on that universal voice that everyone has. And so that's where I felt that if I touched that, then obviously, then maybe somebody else might appreciate it too.
Wow.
So
back in the day, way back in the day, when I was in the University of Iowa, I read something somewhere and it said, a poem should not mean but be.
Beautiful.
And I tried to write a paper on that, and the professor was not impressed.
It is difficult to talk about being, isn't it?
Yeah, right. Probably wasn't a very good paper. I don't know.
No, it probably was. Probably was. Now, when you were traveling in Europe, mm-hmm. you were journaling in
right.
some. Do mm-hmm. you still have those journals?
Actually, I do. And it was really interesting, Monica. The first book I was going to write was going to be about the experience of traveling in Europe, because I just felt it was so educational, liberating in a way, liberating from my own boundaries, from all of the conditioning that I had. I felt very at home in Europe, almost more at home than in Canada, although I love Canada. I feel I'm Canadian, or North America, and now this is my home. But at any rate, I had thought, I'm going to write a book about this, because every young, single woman should go and travel on her own in Europe and experience what it's like to just get beyond all these boundaries we have. And then, and it was a search. I was on the, it was kind of like the self-inquiry. Who am I? Mm-hmm. I had always identified as, well, first of all, you're a woman, and then I'd always identified, I'm a golfer, because everyone knew me as that, or a hockey player, it was in the 20s, you go through that self-searching. So I put it all on little postcards, and then I kept some of my journals. The postcards I sent to my mother, and I said, will you save every single one of these, because I'm going to write a book someday. They're still sitting in my little stash of all those wonderful things you have with my journal, and I don't know when it'll happen, but it's been so long ago. But it was going
to
be.
But it'll bring it all back. It'll bring it to the forefront when you read those.
It will. And that's one of the things I noticed about writing this Sound of the Sacred Beads, this book on India. It, as I wrote it, I was writing it as I was going along. So it started when our first trip in 96. And then just I would put a little piece here and a little piece there. And I had no intention of trying to create any linkage or anything. Just experience India. Mm-hmm. Give the richness as it was happening to me right then. And as it happened, that progressed and then became a book itself, you know. But it, anyway.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Susan Klauber, author of Sound of the Sacred Beads, A Poet's Journey into India. So your first trip to India was in 1996.
Right, and it was about this time. It was December.
And how long did you go for on that first one?
The first trip was only, I believe, 5 weeks. And then each year we just got hooked on it. And each year got a little longer. Well, and you're only allowed to stay 6 months, but there was even one year when we stayed 6 months and then went out of the country to Sri Lanka and then come back in so that you can re-enter because you have a multiple entry visa. So it got longer and longer, and we actually ended up getting an apartment. We were renting there in Bangalore, and we're considering it as a retirement place because it was a lovely, warm spot for us and much... It had a lot of attraction for us, but financially, of course, it's much, much easier too. But then after 9/11, we actually postponed our trip after that. We were scheduled to leave about 10 days after that. And we went in the February of 2002, I guess. And then we ended up giving up our apartment. And then I only went a few times after that, couple of years. So eight winters from 96 till 2007.
And what actually changed your mind about that being your kind of retirement home?
Well, I think mostly I would attribute it to a change kind of in the environment that we were undergoing with, you know, the threat of terrorism, the insecurity and all of that. That kind of put a little damper on everything. But then as things settled down... my husband was really getting frustrated with the ability to try to get things accomplished on his own business side or his own creative side. The bureaucracy was starting to get him, and it's one of the phenomena that you get, and this is one of the things that happens to every Westerner going to India. There's this tremendous bureaucracy inefficiency that you have to deal with. And if you're living there, you actually get to see it on a day-to-day basis. If you're just traveling through, you wouldn't. And if you maintain your equanimity and still stay with the spiritual values that are so charming there, so prevalent, and that is the real value, the real draw of India. If that kind of gets imbalanced and you start saying, well, I've got to get things done. In India, they don't think like we do.
Getting things done isn't
the top priority. Huh?
Isn't the way we would do it, because the charm of their culture is that it fluctuates, it flows. Ours is more of a rational, and this is, of course, a generalization, mm-hmm. and this is my appreciation. Somebody else may have a different one, but our culture seems to be so oriented to a rational, business kind of oriented public life. Mm-hmm. And it's only in your private life that you can kind of relax and slow down. But even right. then, we have so much conditioning to get things accomplished. And I have that within me. That's part of our culture. Get things done. Because you're measured as an individual, what your accomplishments are, and so right. forth. And that seems to dominate. But in India, they still have wonderful, accomplished, you've seen all the creative people and the mm-hmm. very talented individuals, but there's a flow because the whole environment, it's a softer one. I think that it could be because they have more of that orientation to the mother god, rather. We have more of a
father
paternal, kind of image, yeah. And as a dominant right. thing in our culture. That's, again, a generalization, but I think that's a kind of a kernel underlying it. But they are more, everything is just heart-oriented. You're sort of centered in your heart rather than just centered in your head and getting things done.
You have a piece in here about buying postage stamps. You want to share that with,
sure.
as an example of
okay.
dealing with the bureaucracy?
Oh, okay. That is one of the... I've structured the book. I'll just throw in some things here, Monica, in five sections. And each piece flows so that there is an underlying thread that allows it to be read like an original memoir or novel, to coin Rustin Larson's phrase of the book. But in the first chapter, I do get into more of the impression that a Westerner would have on hitting India. And it's just such a shock on many different levels. You have to deal with so many, the trash, the first of all, the huge population. We're not used to that. In Iowa, it is, we have so much space. But one of the pieces in here, right at the beginning, is explaining the difficulty I had when just landing in India. And it's called 12 Time Zones, The Other Side of Order. I'm not sure if you want the whole piece, but I can start in.
Sure.
And it's one of the first pieces in the book, and it starts out with, it's jet lag blues, and that refers to after you've made such a long trip to India, it's 24 hours, 30 hours that you're up and down in airplanes and getting somewhere, and then you've gone through 12 time zones, so you are really jet lagged. So it's jet lag blues. Glazed eyes cave like a barmaid hag. The entire earth weighted into my brainwaves, reducing planetary motion to a gravitational slug. This is my perfect entry to India. 12 time zones, the other side of order, where it takes an hour to find a postcard and the rest of the day to buy the stamp. Indian directions understate. 5 minutes, walk straight along. Clings for 20 minutes, dripping my sweat, skin, and t-shirt into a limping lump. The central post office greets me like a row of jailhouse inmates. 26 barred counter windows, guarded by untranslatable signs, stare down lineups of bodies decomposing in crooked queues that reveal their fake identity only after 15 minutes of waiting. Mutating from one germy cell to the other repeats for several karma-purging incarnations until the proper stamp is secured, pasted securely in its corner, and then diligently scrutinized before the official rubber stamp mashes the face of Gandhi into the worn-out wooden counter. Then it's silent prayer time, as with everything in India. I invoke divine help for the card to reach its final destination. With blessings, it arrives in 2 weeks in America, where a friend reads it in 37 seconds and never comprehends the lifetime of patience worked out of my pores, squeezed and depleted of all Western slick, leaving me an airless vacuum sucking on hope. Indian atmosphere is thin chaos, diesel breathing with no tension, no pressurized pen filling a day planner, street signs, rare sightings. Address numbers on buildings, extinct or indistinct, road maps yet unborn. This is a land of promise for civil engineers, accountants, computer specialists, not cartographers. Maps are unthinkable for things that have remained where they are longer than human imagination. The Brahma cows know. They sit it out, hunched by the road, and rise only occasionally for a lazy amble through speeding stockpiles of scooters and auto rickshaws. My mind, divested of chatter, long ago wiped into the void of 12 time zones, slumps on the other side of Brahma, pavement smells pressed into the ink stamped into my eye slits. Return to sender, addressee unknown.
I really like this piece because it really gave me a feel for culture shock.
Mm-hmm. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Culture shock is something, unless you've been to India, you really can't describe it. We can see pictures and we can talk about having so many people or a huge population, but until you've actually immersed yourself in that, you don't really realize what it does to your physiology. All that energy of different people, of towns, of horns honking. When they drive crazy. And they're always honking horns. You could have, let's give you an example, if you were going down a busy street and there were four lanes, two supposedly on the right and two on the left, and there's a center line. Well, actually, Indians are very flexible. They flow with the traffic, and they'll be driving at crazy speeds, you know, considering how close everybody is to you in the rush hour. And if the traffic is going out of town, well, those two lanes that are going out of town kind of stretch out to three going in this out, and the other lane going in comes down to one, just quite automatically. There aren't any policemen telling you to do it. Just everybody does it. And it's up to the person who's in the other lane to figure out what's going on. So that's why the horns are honking all the time. And if you're on a little auto rickshaw and you're coming up behind another auto rickshaw, you just honk and then kind of slip beside him. And then if another car comes up, they'll honk. So there's this constant honk, honk, honk going on any time you're traffic.
You know, I noticed that in China, too, that there's a whole lot more honking. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, you know, I had my new car, for 6 months before I ever actually used the horn on it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, I'm glad, you know, new cars, you never know where things are. And I'm glad they didn't move where the horn was, or I never would have figured it out when I actually needed it. Mm-hmm. But how often do we need to honk?
Exactly.
Not very often. Mm-hmm. And
fortunately.
Yeah, I was in a hotel. I was on the 14th floor, but I was on the street side, and I could hear the honking.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of honking that mm-hmm. far up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's another interesting thing was that the people that, you know, the business people that I was with, the Westerners do not drive in China. They hire a Chinese driver.
Right.
Because part of it is just because it's very challenging for us
mm-hmm.
to
very similar in
to
India.
Drive in that. Mm-hmm. But the other reason is that if you hit somebody as a Westerner, you are responsible for, regardless of whose fault it is, if you hit a pedestrian, even if they step out in front of you on purpose, which sometimes happens, you're responsible for their care of their family for the rest of their life.
I'm just going to say, really, really, that's, oh gosh.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't know, but I don't think that applies in India, but it is a similar situation where you have so much going on. But one of the...
Did you attempt driving yourself?
No, there? I would never. I never had a car. But most of the, at the time when we were there, cars were only for your wealthier person. Nowadays, they are, obviously, the economy in India is picking up, so there is a enlargening middle class. But the majority of people would use scooters or motorcycles or rickshaws or bicycles.
And how many people would fit on one scooter?
Oh, usually three anyway, if it's a family. I mean, maybe they'd have two children, four.
Yeah.
But yes, I have a piece in here about one called Scooter, of just the child, the father. It's one of those scooters, I can't remember, the Vespa or something, where you don't have a bar between you and the handlebars. You just have the feet. So the child would be standing up holding the handlebars between the father's pant
wow.
legs, and the wife is sitting on the back with her sari. She's sitting side saddle, and sari folds are flapping in the breeze, and so Scooter is sitting there with her hands on the rails, and wow. and just watching her. It was reminiscent of when I was young, the freedom that as a little child, you know, the imagination. But that was one of the pieces. But they do crowd into these rickshaws. Rickshaws basically. A motorcycle with a three-wheeled motorcycle, basically, and the little cabin that they have on the back. The way I describe it in the book, it's like a moving outhouse. You know, I think of Joe Palooka in the many days when you were very old. And this, there's really only two seats in there. I mean, enough room for two, but. Indians are only—they're generally 100 pounds, 5'2" to 5'6", and so they'll fit a whole family in there, six people. Throw in some strangers might come along, and at rush hour you could find six people packed into this little rickshaw.
Wow!
So it's.
Well, Susan, would you like to read another piece
sure,
for us?
Sure.
This is Susan Klauber, Sound of the Sacred Beads, A Poet's Journey into India.
Okay. What I'll do is, since we're on the...
We have plenty of time.
The theme of just at the beginning chapter here and getting into things that are very difficult for Westerners to accomplish or to handle, I'll read a little short, funnier piece. It's called Western Trash Man, and it's about my husband, and it's dealing with the trash. This particular piece was published in MacGuffin magazine a few years ago. Anyway, it's called Western Trash Man. My American engineer husband burns to put trash barrels all over India, start an immediate ad campaign to change 5,000 years of Brahma cows chewing the vegetarian roadkill from human hands. Rice and dal, served on last century's digestible palm leaf, disgorge into today's rickety dirt streets on inedible plastic bags and laminated white cartons haloed from Blue Chip America's scientific genius. If one more boon were granted his elegant subparticle mind, it would be a bounty on all the temple loudspeakers screaming scratchy Indian names of God. Like neurosurgical needles jammed into the eardrum, they pierce and shriek, as unconscionably deafening as the rusty switchblades of political hucksters screeching the streets for a new right-wing, left-wing coalition for sanity. After 2 days of jostling the city streets with the noise trash density of 900 million Indians jackhammering the tidy Iowa plains of his bones, he starts wearing ear blockers, industrial strength, imported from his U.S. lab. He carries the chocolate wrapper, thoughtfully, for 3 hours, then silently drops it in the streets. And this is one of the adjustments that every Westerner has to come
to. So each time you go, you have to readjust a lot of things.
You do. That's an interest. You know, it's good that you brought that point up.
Uh-huh.
I was reading this at the when I first launched this book here in Fairfield, and some of the friends had been to India several times, and they said, "Oh, you've captured that. It's just like I had to re-enter again into India." Mm-hmm. So they had to go through all of that initial shock. But you get more and more flexible, and that is one of the aspects that. It leads into a charming aspect of the Indians, their ability to adjust, to accept what's going on, which is something that I had to learn and every Westerner has to learn. We're so oriented to having our own way, or we're individuals and our individuality speaks, and the group is has to adjust to me, or if the group isn't going my way,
I go find another group.
Yes, exactly. But they have a different. They blend. They accept, and so you'll see an Indian's ability to handle noise, to handle all kinds of things that we would never do. Getting into a temple, if it's some kind of a festival or something, and you get tremendous crowds going in there, and they'll all squat on the floor and sit there, and you have to find a spot. And usually the women are separate from the men. Women on one side usually and men on the other, although it doesn't have to be, but it's generally the way it goes. So I might be sitting, and I have a woman on my right and a woman on my left, one in front and one in back, and there might be, I describe in here, I had like 6 inches, literally, of space between our knees as we're squatting. And somebody else would come in and wedge her way in there and go right in between the two. And everybody, the Indians just adjust and make room, because we have to make room for another person, you know, when you're in one of these spiritual things. This rush for the divine is very embedded in their blood. And you just adjust. If you don't, you can go crazy. I can remember having meditations, wonderful meditations, in the midst of all kinds of noise. You're in a temple and there's people back and forth, or there's, you know, just so much going on. And then more crowds come in, and you're sitting there very peacefully squatted on the floor, and they're asking you to move up so they can make more room for the people behind. And you just can't move. Well, people are crawling over me and everything, but I'm just having such a... So I've adjusted. At that point, I knew I had adjusted to India.
Yeah. What's it like adjusting back when you come back to the States? Is that challenging as well?
Well, you know, usually for somebody like me, who has traveled and lived in the West so much, you kind of feel a little bit of relaxation come in that you didn't have. But it's not a relaxation on the kind of soul level. It's just a little relaxation that my mind says, oh, yes, now I've got my nice little conditioning back that I can have. But
everyone's going to respect my personal space here.
Exactly. There's going to be privacy. There's going to be silence. There's going to be order. But I knew that I had really merged more with India 1 year when I came back. And I landed in Iowa, and I thought, my gosh, it's so quiet here. And I said, where are all the people? They're not walking along the streets. You can drive down a street in Iowa, and there's nobody walking on the streets, not a soul. In India, that would be unheard of. You'd always see somebody walking on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And it became like, it was like a little spooky. It was so quiet. And I realized, oh boy, I'm really becoming Indian, you know, in a way. But I really, that expression that you could eat off the streets, you really could. Here, but in India it was like completely different.
I don't think so.
But that's just one aspect. That's the initial shock. The book itself, that's just the kind of the first chapter. And even then, there's more charm of the Indian people that is alluded to in the first part. And the charm is that these people have such, as I mentioned earlier, accepting nature, but they are oriented to being very present with you. We, at least from my experience, when you're in public and you meet somebody, you might have 5 or 10% of your energy is going into that person meeting. Otherwise, you've got something else going on in your mind, or you're aware of the crowd around you, or there's something going on. You're not quite there, but yet you are. You could be the friendliest, giving them all your energy, but yet there's something held back. And in India, it's just a completely different thing. It's like they look at you and they're right there. I'll read a little section.
Okay.
It's called Indian Persona. They don't seem to have a persona I am familiar with, the front guard around the heart. I get used to their curiosity. Eyes stare at me like a child, gaping at the new kid on the block. No attempt to hide the focus. No edge of judgment separates us. No glare of distrust burns the subconscious airwaves. The interchange is more like water pouring into water. The surface swirls and bubbles for a moment of temporary displacement, then settles as the two waters merge, indistinguishable from each other. Eyes are simply benign channels for the flow of awareness from their being to mine. Their open heart, an essential force in the package of human interaction. It is impossible for me to feel threatened by innocence, and I'll switch to the last. I go on and describe a lot more of different people and experiences of people coming up to me and talking to me from everywhere. I describe it like, it's like popcorn jettisoning into the air. They come rapid fire at you with so many questions like, where are you from? You like India? The food? What is your profession? You met him? How many children you have? It'll just all roll out. You know, they're so curious. And
some questions that we wouldn't consider asking a stranger.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Here.
Yes, you know, like no subject seems taboo. What is your salary? Slithers through the air like a giant eel, bending as easily around the cost of our plane ticket as the effect of the food on our regularity. I want Visit America. What is your address? But you realize after a while that they're like I describe here, a rapid fire takeover by a stranger comes as a mixed bag of humorous delight and caution. Can anyone be this cheerful and curious without a pocket to pick or a setup for fleecing? I get used to the South Indian candor and the boundless energy in speaking to us. I am embarrassed by the speed with which I put up my defensive guard and suspect their motives so quickly. I revisit the boundaries I carry with me, relearning my codes of safe conduct, this time within the reach of my heart. I check my spiritual bank book and have to admit that simple innocence like that in my quiet meditation does not spread out to strangers, to strange lands. What makes anything strange anyway? What would I be like if I never had the boundary of separateness cast its fear into my awareness, if I could truly open in trust, live the truth behind differences, safe in the hands of God? Is it possible that the wisdom of the ancient rishis that I have sought for years comes down to the state of my heart? Mm-hmm. And this is basically what the journey then is about. More about getting into the heart of India and getting into your own heart and making that little shift from being so oriented to a rational base, a logic, everything orderly, space, privacy, individuality, to a more merging, flowing, what I might call female-oriented or motherly kind of that nourishing quality, and accepting and flowing. And that quality is very prevalent in the Indian culture. And you would find some that are Western-oriented kind of, and they love America. They just love it. They love everything about it, and, you know, they like the movies and things like that. But they still have this completely heart-oriented and flowing nature that seems so very, very different from ours. But one of the things that quality you start to try to figure out, and I tried to analyze, now why is it that people are so accepting, accommodate? And I wondered, is it because there's so many people, you just have to accept what's going on? And actually, I write a little piece about that, but I explain, well, it can't be that people are just forced into accepting, or it can't be just because there's a lot of people, because it would be in every culture then, any culture where there's a lot of people.
And, yeah.
But here, I took one of the basic elements is the harmonizing influences. I started thinking of them, and I kept thinking of what I understood from all of the Vedic chanting and all of the different sounds, and this is where it comes back to the title of the book, Sound of the Sacred Beads. The sacred beads are those mantras or those sounds of the Vedas that have been chanted in India for thousands and thousands of years. It's that oral tradition that is still maintained by their pundits, and they chant that, and it's an amazing harmonizing influence that happens. And I figured that is going on, even if you're not even spiritual. I mean, it's hard to describe an Indian as not having some spiritual basis, or any person for that matter. We all have a spiritual basis, but whether it's active in your life or in your awareness is another aspect. But there, I just felt that this harmonizing influence was throughout. It kind of flows, and I just went back to that must be because of all of this chanting that has been going, all these Vedic sounds, which are fundamental sounds of creation. And I go back to an expression that I had learned from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi when he was describing that he talked about soma. He said it's like the glue of the universe, he called it, that glue between matter and spirit, which we all have that interface, and we wouldn't be human. That's what life is, matter and spirit together. And soma kind of links it up, brings it all, makes it all flowy and put it all together, and that's what we touch on in our life when we're really merging with our own spiritual core. And that's basically what I felt was so beautiful about India. You could merge with your spiritual core because it's they're merged with their spiritual core, and that it makes you, it brings you back more to yourself. And of course, having the benefit of so many years of meditation and all the knowledge that of self-knowledge that one gets from that, and the ability to harmonize and learn all of that from your own self by touching that very silent core within yourself, you are doing what we are all meant to do in our life, is to bring out not just our active life, but bring out that spiritual core and then bring that into our life so that we are living a full range. We're not recluses hiding in the woods, but we're not also just so cold and alienated from our own spiritual core and our feeling level that we are, you know, disconnected from everything. And I think that's happening around the world. It's the whole merging, and that's what we all do. That's our job, I guess, as human beings. That's what we're here for. At least that's the way I assess it. And so this is what the book is basically gets into more and more.
And the book is The Sound of the Sacred Beads, A Poet's Journey into India by Susan Klauber.
And the people have heard this chanting, this music of the soul from birth.
Mm-hmm.
So it is absolutely part of their...
It's been
everything,
going
on. Part of their cells, part of everything.
Exactly, exactly.
Part of their genes.
Right. And I figure it's... Well, we know the nourishing quality. Your mother, you know that link that you have with the child.
Mm-hmm.
It's inseparable, no matter how many miles might put you apart. That quality, I mean, it's prevalent in everyone, whether you're a male or not, but it's I could just call it a motherly instinct or whatever, or fatherly, perhaps. But that, it's nourished with all of that,
mm-hmm.
that chanting. It's just basically... And that's one of the things of India. It's the mother divine quality that I had never really been raised with. I had been I've been spiritual, I guess, if that's a word, you know, you could coin from youth. I was very interested. Even I turned my golf into, it was like a spiritual quest, you know. and all of my travels were spiritual quests in a way, more self quests. Self-inquiry, self like that. And going to India, one of the real treats was to be able to see that mother divine quality prevalent in a culture. And it opened something else up for me. But they have that radiating, and it comes from all of this chanting, all these... we think of Mother Earth. And that, mm-hmm. I remember asking one of these holy people or saintly people in India, I said, I really don't relate to all of these gods. I mean, I don't understand all these gods that you have and all that. And she said, well, there is only one God for everybody. But everybody's trying to get there. There are many, many people trying to get the same place. So it's better to have many doors to get there. And that's the attitude of India. And they said, God comes in many different forms, and male, female, whatever, many different forms to suit the person so that they can get to that ultimate destination. And so in India, you have that personal form of God, which can be in many different formats, you know, Shiva and Saraswati and Vishnu and whatever. But then you can have the unmanifest, the formless, the one, and that underlies everything. And that is basically what I understood about India. I could see it working there. And they accept every person's religion, whatever it is. You know, they just...
And yet, the Hindus and Muslims were killing each other.
Exactly. It seemed like so contradictory to me. I did mention that in one place.
Yeah.
I think it comes down to when you have it's like, well, you can even think of the Middle East. You know, there's people relate to their religion or their feeling, their belief based on a geographical area or a place or an object or a temple or a mosque or whatever. And if some other religion comes in and destroys that, that's an insult. That's an insult to their very core. And so they will fight back. And I feel that's at the basis of what's going on in the world today, that we are having to learn to go beyond, to see the basis of our religion as being a more spiritual, universal quality. And the basic thing of India is, when it's at its core, is universal, because the idea that the world is my family, they live that. It's there, and it's particularly among the spiritual people. But one of the things you have to understand, too, that in India, they've been invaded by every different culture.
Right.
Their history has, they've been overtaken by so many people. And they, to them, a temple, to the spiritual ones, and that's the majority. And I'm talking mostly here about the Hindu basis, because that was based, the majority are Hindu, although there are Muslims and Christians, there's every religion there, but the majority live with the Hindu customs. But they don't treat, like we might say, a church, and, you know, it's sacrilegious to do something against the church, but to them it's like their own blood. You know, it's like treating your family poorly or treating anything that is God's. And if you were to see everything in the world as God, even your neighbor or the divine, if I were to meet you, I mean, the whole idea of namaste is, you know, putting the hands together is folding, it's a greeting of one universal quality to another. The divine in me greets the divine in you. It goes way back, but through time and everything, they lose things, like we lose the basis of our culture. So I do think that at the essence of the whole Vedic tradition, there's beautiful harmony and everything like that.
You have a piece in here about a sermon about Christ.
Right.
From a Hindu.
Exactly.
That was one of, and would you share that?
I really appreciated that.
It actually was a Christmas sermon, right?
It was. Well, I didn't go too much into the sermon. Let me see if I can even find which page.
I mean, maybe sermon. I don't know if sermon is the word that they use. I guess it's not. It doesn't really apply.
No, they call them discourses.
Well, you're looking for that. I want to mention, in our American Indian culture, they have their chants. They have that, and the connection with the earth is their, their connection with God is the earth and the animals and so forth, and that, you know, it's universal, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. That's the Vedic thing. It is universal. And yeah. I was looking at India from that perspective. And when you really do get immersed with the different spiritual people that are there, I'm talking about just the average person who would go and have their puja every day. We go to church like once a week. But there, it's every day or some auspicious event, and there's auspicious days every time. Those events are going on all the time, and one of the things is going way back to the old ancient rishis. It's very similar to what I would think would be the Western or the native culture here, is that the earth is very sacred. It's holy, and we learn from the earth, because Mother Earth, and we still use that phrase, Mother Earth.
We do. Right.
And actually, that was one of the things that I had mentioned to this holy woman. I call them Mother Earth. She, oh, yes, that's it. That's the same thing, you know. It's the mother quality. Yes, that's mother. So if you regard Mother Earth as sacred, as you, as divine, and you are divine, then it's part of you. And so that's similar to the... in India, there would be a ceremony to... If you go into your home the first time, because you want it to be sacred. So there'd be a little ceremony for that. Or when they put the plants in, you know, you'd have some sacred ceremony that would be performed because this is part. So you're living a more holistic aspect.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Susan Klauber, the author of Sound of the Sacred Beads, A Poet's Journey into India.
You know, I could read part of this Christmas night with Divine Mother just till we get to the part about the sermon, but I was wondering,
we're running short of time.
I did want to just give one essential little experience.
Okay.
And it was the very first time we've talked about the mother quality, and my very first time experiencing a little place that was sacred. And it was, we'd only been in India for a very short time, and they regard light energy places as being holy. So there might be a mountain that's considered a mountain of Shiva. You know, that is something you would circumambulate. You would go around it in order to get the blessing of that. And it's not like it's part of their nature. It's the arduous task of pilgrimage. So pilgrimage is part of their nature. And beside this road, there was just this, we were in the foothills of the Himalayas along the Ganges going up north of Rishikesh, and it's called Kunjadevi, and it's a little hill and then by the side of the road, but it was considered very sacred. And I'll read the little excerpt before it. When Lord Shiva's beloved wife died, he was in such sorrow, he carried her body with him. Lord Vishnu and the other gods saw this and decided to take her body and scatter it over India. Kunjadevi Temple is the place where the heart of Mother Divine landed. And these are all the wonderful stories that you get to explain. Mm-hmm. And this was, there's a little, my maiden name was Mackie, but that would be pronounced Maki the way it is. So I'm explaining that because I do use those two words in here, and they're different pronunciation, but they're written exactly the same. Just a simple hill wedged beside the mountain road, unsuspecting drying shrubs greeting me, with 100 stone steps, a retaining wall, and a single chalked graffiti, J. Maki. My maiden name was Mackie. Maybe I am expected. Too far from home for coincidences, but too old to be naive, I slip by the sign, up the steps, slowly, into the sky, where the past stops. Without even realizing it, the heart had been thrown away, too worn to hear its fall, until it landed here, echoing in its own thick amber silence. I am a solitary temple, a pinnacle for listening to the mountains fall away. Pilgrims stand at the edge, motionless cutouts in the sky. Eyes point over the valley, seeing nothing but her inside, breathing without lungs or hands, without dreams or promises. She keeps calling, even as my body kneels in its first ever Indian gesture of humility. She doesn't notice the awkward start, waiting until I am face down, hands in the earth, to swallow me whole. I know nothing, except I am her child, lush velvet of peace, gratitude flowing through the gentlest essence of me in the grace of her radiant humility. And there's a follow-up piece called The Goddess Wears Crystal, and I'll just read a couple of lines from that. When I knelt, I felt so whole, so at home to be her. But God has always been it, or male. And that was a transformation for me. And the next poem I have is called Mother God. I was raised a Lutheran with only a Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. But I kneel in Indian temples to Mother, her thousand names burned into the breath of my woman's body. And so that's where it comes with Christmas night and with Mother Divine. And she was one who explained, you know, the essence of all the religions. There's one basis at the beginning of it.
Can you read that little bit?
Yes,
too?
I will.
Great.
It was, I think we've got time.
Yeah.
Christmas night with Divine Mother. We wait in a small temple with a few hundred Indians and three other Westerners, intimate, like Mother, seated close enough to see the silence in her eyes, the red and gold painted toes, the Sanskrit letters Om carved into the wooden headrest of her chair. Hindu goddesses, coated with hundreds of flowers, deep purple, red, and yellow, mass for pujas and evening arati. On the sidelines, one potted fur-like plant, 5 feet tall, mostly air, bends its spindly branches into the room, like a telephone pole with four scarecrow arms. Air and arms intersperse with 12 assorted baubles and a single gold paper star, lone testament of Christianity interrupting the catechism of Vedic symbols. It stands unsuspecting witness to the best Christmas sermon I ever heard. Christ seen through the enlightened eyes of the cosmic mother. Shaking her head with tender admiration and love, she whispers, "Christ, so much compassion for the world." Divine avatars can take on the pain and suffering of man, dissolve it through their own bodies with only a brief physical illness. Her radiance and gentle words, penetrating new depths, transport us into his loving reality. Christ revealed in the same light as Buddha, Ramakrishna, the Vedic rishis, a single breath drawn over the earth from the time of creation, filling the vacancy in our collective heart, individualized by the mirage of separation. Matter and spirit sliced at the umbilical, baptized, anointed with a code of words, exhaled so long ago, their meaning is forgotten. I feel Christ glowing in the room, in my eyes, in the center of my heart. My being is like a candle reignited by the flame from her heart. He was her child too, one of her greatest sons. And I can only think this is true and wonder what would I be like if my church had ever talked of Buddha or Ramakrishna or the long line of India's great rishis with the same respect as Christ. Would I have learned about the Inquisition in high school history? Would my golf club have allowed Jews as members before 1954? And I think we're going to be running
out
of time.
We are.
That's just... So this book is available locally.
Yes, you can get it at Revelations Bookstore.
Mm-hmm. And for our listeners out of town?
They can get it on Amazon.com. They could order it at any bookstore,
okay. But
they may need the ISBN number, and I don't know if they'll ever... But they could try Sound of the Sacred Beads. Susan Klauber, and they will order it, but Amazon.com.
And do you have a website?
I don't have a website.
Okay.
I've been trying to set up a Facebook ad page.
Okay.
I'm really out of it, but thank you very much.
Well, we are out of time, and thank you for listening to Writer's Voices.
Thank you so
much for being here, and we have a quote from Mom.
Yeah, because this is my favorite
wrap
quote.
Wrap it up.
What would you choose to do if you knew you could not fail?
See you next week on Writer's Voices, and stay tuned if you're listening on Friday to Planet Erstwhile with our ever-loving host, James Moore.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.